This is the Past Lives podcast, episode 295, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at Past Lives podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We will look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. And please look out for the Past Lives podcast episodes that are called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. So today I'm bringing together some of my favourite episodes. I've cut out clips from the interviews that I remember well, even though some of them are from 2 or 3 years ago. So in these clips are near-death experiences, reincarnation stories, and mediumship. So I'm going to start with a clip from episode 105, which was an interview with Jeff Olson. Jeff was in a terrible car crash that led to his NDE. His wife and one of his two sons died in the crash. Jeff suffered multiple life-threatening injuries, including the amputation of his left leg above the knee. As a result of the accident, he had profound out-of-body, shared death, and near-death experiences. So in this section, we hear how he found peace through his spiritual experiences.
What I found particularly amazing was the point where you were visited by the nurse and the doctor who looked after you just after the crash.
Yeah, that was incredible. In fact, and let me go to that. When I was life flighted into level one trauma center, you know, they knew I was coming. Obviously, they knew there had been a fatality. But one of the doctors, Dr. Jeff O'Driscoll, and I believe he's going to be on your show or may have already been, he was like the attending level one trauma physician, you know, a seasoned ER doctor. And he wasn't necessarily responsible for my care, but when they life flighted me into the hospital, one of the nurses who he had spoken to, Dr. O'Driscoll's an interesting fellow. He's a doctor, and as I said, he has huge experience in the ER, but he's a very spiritual guy. And he had shared with one of these nurses some of the things he sees in the ER sometimes as souls go or come. He said death is much like birth. It's just that the doors are different. But anyway, he's a very spiritual guy, and so she ran and got him and said, "You've got to come down to the trauma room where I was being worked on." And the doctor walked in, and the nurse had felt and seen the presence of my wife who had passed. Tamara was there in the ER room as they were working on my body. And the nurse had seen it and sensed it and went and got Dr. O'Driscoll, and he came in. And the way Dr. O'Driscoll explains it is he walked in and he saw my wife's soul standing in the air above my body as all the doctors worked on me. And he said she communicated with him, not necessarily with words, but non-verbally, that she was thankful for all they were doing to save my life, you know, because we had this little boy. I came back to raise my son. And the doctor, this may be the biggest miracle, when I was out of, you know, the ICU and into surgical recovery, he and this nurse came to visit me. And I found it interesting because they were just starting to let people come and see me from work and from the neighborhood. And they came in and I didn't recognize them. And I thought they were a couple because they were in normal clothes and it was a man and a woman, just my, you know, assumption. And I thought, I don't remember who they are. I don't know that I know them. And then they finally introduced themselves as my trauma team. We were members of your trauma team. And I thought, my gosh, how kind is it for you to come see me? And it was small talk a little bit, but finally the nurse kind of pulled up a chair and sat near me, and she started to cry. She took tissues from my little hospital, you know, stand there, and she started to cry, and she said, we must tell you why we came. And she was very emotional about the fact that she had seen my wife, Tamara, or seen her soul in the ER room. And I found it fascinating. I actually just listened and I began to weep because I thought, okay, this is really interesting that I had this profound out-of-body or near-death experience. My wife was so near. The fact that this nurse, you know, saw something and experienced something and is willing to share it is really powerful for me to say, not that I needed validation, but it's like, yeah, something really was happening in that moment when I was out of the body and saying goodbye and all those things. I glanced up at Dr. O'Driscoll, who was kind of standing in the corner of the room, and I made eye contact with him, and he affirmed, he nodded his head, and he shared that he also experienced her and that she was communicating with him. And I'm like, what did she say, you know? And when he said she simply was sharing her gratitude for all we were doing to save your life, I burst into tears. I thought that's exactly what she would do. That's her. That's her heart, you know? And so that was an interesting scenario because it opened up a space where, gosh, I had a doctor that was willing to share that he had had these, you know, these experiences. And so I was able to share with him a little bit about my experience. And one of the experiences I shared with him after I got out of the hospital, at this visit, they kind of went on their way, but the doc kept checking on me. And I would ask him and talk to him about things. And it wasn't until after I got out of the hospital that I really began to share. But I thought, you know, if I'm crazy, he'll get me the psychiatric assistance I need. But everything was so real to me. And knowing that he had seen something like that, I felt safe in sharing. But I'll go back to when I was in the light, when I said I was home, because that was a very interesting download. And this is one of the first things I shared with Dr. O'Driscoll after I got out of the hospital. But this was at the end of my hospital stay, as I mentioned, and I'm in this place I'm calling home, but I get the knowing that I'm not meant to stay there. And forgive me for jumping around, but this may be the pinnacle and highlight of the entire out of body or near death experience. And I don't know, but I've got to touch on that. So there I was in where I called home. I get this knowing that I'm not there to stay. And at that same time, there's this corridor off to my left that I just simply know intuitively I've got to go down that way. And so I began to make my way down the corridor. And I could see at the end of the corridor is a crib. And Griffin, my little son that passed, who was just a toddler at the time, he was sleeping in a crib when, you know, at the time of the accident. But so when I saw this crib, I raced to the crib and I looked in, and there was Griffin. There was my little boy, and he was sleeping as peacefully and beautifully as I'd ever seen. And I can't stress how physical everything felt. Like, I could feel the ground under my feet. I went and picked up my son. And, you know, have you ever picked up a sleeping child, Simon?
Yeah, I've got two daughters.
Yeah, you know, the weight and the heat, and I couldn't even speak of this for years. I would just cry, but I picked up my little boy and I could feel him solid against me. I could feel his warm breath on my neck. I reached over and I, as a father, you might relate to this, but I smelled his hair. I'm just like, it's my little boy. He's okay. And I'm here getting to say goodbye to him too. And as I held him, I felt this presence behind me, an overwhelming presence. It was so wise and big and cosmic, and I words are difficult to explain, but as I held my little boy, I realized, wow, I'm in the presence of God. I'm in the presence of that voice that's been speaking to me, and I actually began to be a little bit fearful. Because I grew up, you know, in a conservative Christian home, and I thought, wow, my little boy is here because I crashed the car. My little boy's life was cut short because I messed up and had the accident, and I began to be filled with all those feelings like I had been, you know, since the accident, and I thought, this powerful force behind me, if this is God, I'm probably in big trouble. I had grown up believing that God was going to judge me, that I was probably in trouble, that life was a test, and I was most likely failing. And I, you know, so I had this fear within me, and I had the thought as this, and it almost felt physical too. This being came so close, I didn't dare turn around. I thought, I don't dare turn around. And the feeling I had was, I hope there's some way I can be forgiven. And Simon, I can't even explain what it felt like or what happened. But as soon as I said that, it felt like those divine arms just wrapped around both me and my son. We were being held. And suddenly the lid just came off. There was this huge download of peace and love and connection. It was that oneness, but this oneness was all about my life. And I suppose this is where I had the life review. I began to see my life. And I would think, oh, no, that was a mistake, you know. And I was in all this judgment. And, you know, when I had had the thought, I hope I can be forgiven, and those arms wrapped around me, it's like the whole universe just said, there's nothing to forgive. Everything has always been in perfect divine order.
So now we move on to an interview with Mike Anthony. When Mike's father unexpectedly died, his family was left shocked and utterly devastated. However, Mike received a phone call out of the blue from someone saying that Mike's dad had contacted her from the other side. You got contact from your cousin Chris.
Yes. So mediumship is something that I had been only sort of superficially aware of. When I was in high school, there was a show on television called Crossing Over with John Edward, which I'm sure, you know, people are mostly familiar with. And I'd watched that and thought, well, it's certainly interesting. But it's a TV show. Who knows how produced it is. And I also was thinking, well, it can't be true. Because if it's that easy for a person to gain evidence of life after death, surely someone would have looked into this. Some scientist or multiple scientists would have looked into this, and I would have learned about it in my science classes. Someone would have said, oh, yes, the body can do this, 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 and this. Oh, and by the way, one of its other faculties is the ability to hear messages from dead people. But because no professor of mine had ever taught us that, I was thinking, surely what John Edward is doing, though interesting, there can't be a whole lot behind it. So that was my awareness of mediumship at the time that my dad passed. So a call comes into my mom's house very soon after my dad died. And we're all still very much in the throes of grief. And it's a distant cousin of mine. And when my mom first called me to tell me what happened, she said, so I got a call from Chris. And I said, Chris, I can't even picture this person. That's how distant of a cousin this is. He had never called our house before. As it turned out, Chris, my distant cousin, he at the time had a big time job as a hospital administrator. And that's what the family thought that he did. He had a hobby, as it turns out. On the weekends, he had a group of investigators who formed what they called a paranormal investigative team. And they would go to houses and try to detect evidence of paranormal, quote unquote, paranormal activity. And he had never told many people in his life about this because of his job. There's such a stigma around this subject that he was worried that if his higher ups got wind of what he was doing on the weekends, that might cause trouble for him at work. So he was just very tight-lipped about it. And so that's why we had never heard anything at all about this. On his team, Chris said, he has a medium. And at one of their investigations that week, he realized that it was my dad. I don't know that he ever met my father in person. That's how distant of a cousin we're talking about. He knew through the family vine that my dad had passed. Again, it was such a shock, so he had gotten wind of it secondhand. But he eventually realized that this person talking to his medium was not connected to that house they were investigating at all. It was my father. Apparently, because he ended up giving his name and my sister's name. And that's how Chris ended up realizing that this was my father. So Chris and I are now close, and we laugh about this because the poor guy, you know, he was not close with us. So he was being the medium was telling him, you have to get this message to this family. You have to do it. And Chris was saying to her, I don't, how am I going to do that? I can't just call them, you know, and say, hey, your dead father came through to my medium friend, you know, because he didn't know anything about what our beliefs might be, religious or otherwise, and or what sort of state of grief we were in. He just had no idea how we might take a phone call like this. My dad was apparently so insistent with this medium friend of his that Chris eventually made the call to my mom and told her the story. So then my mom called me, and being the person that I am, I had to get to the bottom of that. So I immediately called Chris. We spent a long time on the phone. I got the information about his medium friend from him. And then I subsequently set up a meeting with her on the phone, and we spoke for a very long time. And she ended up saying some things to me during that phone call. One of which included a butterfly. And this was right after I had that butterfly experience on the subway. She said to me that day on the phone, there's something about a big butterfly. Anyway, she said other things that were pretty right on. What I concluded from that phone call was that, A, this woman wanted nothing, it seemed, but to deliver a message that she believed was from my dad. There was no money, of course, exchanged, not even the intimation that she wanted anything from us at all. It just seemed that she believed my dad desperately wanted to get these messages to us. She seemed kind. She seemed compassionate. She seemed smart. And mainly, she seemed quite sane. You know, she just seemed like a lovely woman. So I told my sister about this. We spoke a lot about this. And then directly after that, my sister was driving to work a few days later. And she had her radio on. And there happened to be a segment on a radio station featuring a medium. So this was another synchronicity that seemed quite striking. You know, we had just gotten this phone call out of the blue telling us that this medium wanted to get this message to us. I had just spoken to this medium. And then directly after that, my sister hears someone who is now a quote unquote professional medium on the radio. And it happened that she lived in Connecticut, this medium. My sister found out that she was going to be doing a group event where she'd have about 100 people in a theater space, and she'd be doing readings for people. So given the coincidence of the timing of all of this, Jen thought, well, maybe we should check into this. So she got tickets to go see this medium, a woman named Angelina Diana, here in Connecticut.
What was the thing, the kind of tipping point that tipped you over to actually think this is real? This is really happening.
Yes, I definitely maintained doubts. My brain worked in such a way that I would have these moments, like such as the butterfly, and believe, or in that moment, I was 100% certain this is my dad. And an hour later, inevitably, my brain would be thinking, well, what about this? What about that? My brain just would not let me have it. You know, it took a great deal to ultimately convince me. So the moment for me that really began this journey was the following week. So as I said, Jen had hired Angelina to come to our house the following week to do a reading just with my family. So I set up a similar experiment that my sister had done. She'd spoken out loud to my dad, asked him to deliver a specific message. And I thought, well, that should be repeatable, right? That repeatability, of course, is one of the pillars of science. So I was standing alone at my dad's house that day. Angelina was scheduled to come over about an hour later. And I said, okay, Dad, I've got to come up with a code word here. I need you to deliver me a specific message like you did for Jen, or I'm not going to be able to believe this. And as I'm thinking about it, I was suddenly flooded with the memory that when I was a little kid, my mom and my dad had gotten divorced when we were very young. So my sister and I would spend the weekends with him. And we were always so excited to see him on Friday and Saturday nights. It was hard for us to go to sleep. So we would beg my poor father to play with our hair at night to help us fall asleep. And the guy would have to do it for, you know, an hour. And as his hand must have been so cramped. And, you know, five more minutes, Dad, five more minutes. And of course, being who he was, he would play with my hair until I fell asleep. So for whatever, I hadn't thought about that in years, but for whatever reason, that memory washed over me. And I said, okay, that's it, Dad. I need this woman tonight to mention my hair. I need her to specifically mention my hair in some way. If you don't get her to do that, I'm not going to believe anything else that she says. Now, I should also say, Simon, that my hair is entirely average. It's just if you looked at my hair, you would not be able to pick it out of a sea of heads. It's just average, you know, brown hair. So Angelina comes to the house, and this is the first time I'm meeting her. And she claims that she does not remember my sister at all either from that from the reading she'd done a week earlier. And I didn't know if that was true or not. I should also say I sort of scrubbed the house of any evidence. You know, I went around taking down any photos that were up. I tried to, I wanted the room to be as sterile as possible so that there wouldn't be things that Angela, this woman could be gleaning any information from. So we sat down, and again, she gave her spiel about how she works, and then she started. And right from the beginning, she was saying things that were very difficult for me to understand how she could know them without actually hearing my dad's in some way. It's a lot to get into. It's all in the book, so I won't bore you with all of those details. But the one that changed my life was we were wrapping up to leave, actually. We had all had an amazing night, and the information was such that we were all crying at the end of it, myself included. And I had totally forgotten about my experiment, because I was thinking, this is real. I don't know how this is real, but this is real. She had said too many things by that point for me to think she could just be cold reading us somehow. There's just no way. So we're wrapping up to leave. We're telling her what an amazing night we had. Now, if you are a charlatan, right, if you are faking this, you know when to head out the door, right? You have all of these suckers crying. They're all going to tell everyone in their life that this was the most amazing thing they've ever experienced. You're going to get a ton of work out of this, right? If you are faking this, you know that's your time to leave. But instead, as we're standing there saying our goodbyes, crying, she looks right at me. There are about seven of us there. She looked right at me, and she said, she was mid-sentence, by the way, Simon. She was in the middle of talking, and she stopped. And I could tell she went back into that sort of trancy state. She stopped mid-sentence, then looked right at me and said, "Your dad wants to talk about your hair." And she made this motion with her hand above her head, like as though, you know, playing with someone's hair. And that it is safe to say that that moment completely changed the direction of my life.
Hello, this is me, Simon. Did you know that during a past life regression, you can meet with your spirit guide? I conduct past life regression sessions over Zoom, and I've guided many clients to a spiritual encounter with their guide. If you would like to ask me how a session would work for you, you can book a free 20-minute consultation on my website, pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The link is in the show notes. Okay, so now we're going to move on to Mickey Havelock. When Mickey's heart stopped in 2014, panic erupted. But as medical staff moved into overdrive, Mickey herself was blissfully unaware of the commotion. Instead, she was enjoying the calmest yet most exhilarating experience of her life. In many ways, it was a classic near-death experience. With that near-death experience, that didn't seem like things were so bad, but how did it start? What's the first thing that you saw?
So when I was actually in hospital, and they've already told me afterwards that if I hadn't have been in A&E, I probably wouldn't have survived. They wouldn't have been able to bring me back. So it's quite interesting that I was there when it happened. You know, I do believe in that sort of divine timing of everything. But when it actually, when the point came when I died, if you like, I was just, for me, like I said, I mean, I was with my daughter and I just said to her, the doctor had gone off to organize an emergency camera down my throat because she was like, we think it might be a burst ulcer. We want to get a camera down to see what's going on, why you're in so much pain, because it's definitely not your heart. So, and I remember saying to her, I don't really care what you do. Just do whatever to get this pain to stop. So she went off. And I just looked at my daughter and I said, I've got to tell you, I think I'm going to pass out. Because I'd started to become really lightheaded. And it was just like I was very faint. And I said, so I think I'm going to pass out. And she walked around the bed to get me a glass of water. And when she was on her way back round, that's when she realized that I'd gone into a massive seizure. And then everything happened on the monitors and I literally had this seizure apparently, and then everything flatlined and stopped. For me, I literally said to her, I think I'm going to pass out. And then when I turned to look the other way, there was my husband who had died 4 years previously with cancer and what have you. And I was just so excited to see him. It was the most natural thing. It just felt so natural that he would be there. And I just remember looking at him and being so excited and just jumping off the bed and into his arms and just holding him and breathing him in and drinking him in and just soaking in him because I'd missed him so much for 4 years. And it didn't even cross my mind that this was weird or maybe I was dead. It just didn't cross my mind.
And you say he looked quite young. How young did he look?
Well, he looked how he did when I first ever met him. I mean, we've been together 21 years. And I was 21 when I met him, just turned 21. And he was, I think, 26. Just about to turn 27. So that's how old he looked. He looked in his early 20s and just in his prime and just exactly as I remember him when I first ever met him. He didn't look, you know, how he did at the end of his life when he was so ill and frail and fragile. He was young and vibrant and just full of light and love and energy.
Next, you saw your grandparents who were also younger versions of themselves.
Yeah. And you know, here's the thing. I mean, I didn't know them as young people. I didn't know them as, you know, how they presented to me. But it didn't matter because I instantly knew who they were. And the same as one of my grandfathers, I never met him, Simon. He died before I was born. But I knew him. I knew him straight away. I mean, I'd experienced him as a child myself, having my own mediumistic, you know, experiences. I'd had visitations and people's sort of faces floating around my room, etc. And he was very much one of those. But regardless, I knew who he was. I knew he was my grandfather. And like I said, it's a knowing. I think in some ways it went to show me that, you know, when we're here, we've crossed, if you like, the veil, as they call it. Some people call it, you know, the veil between that world and this. And as we pass through that veil, a lot of our memories or a lot of our what we know that life to be gets left behind, because I think it would be too much to have all of it in our memory now. You know, it would mean that every time life got hard or anything, we'd be like, oh yeah, can't be dealing with this, might just go home, you know?
Well, the next clip is from episode 33, where I interviewed Jenny Cockle. Jenny has always known she has lived before. In her previous life, her name was Mary. She was an Irish woman who died 21 years before Jenny was born, leaving several very young children without a mother. You have these memories. The first of all we're going to talk about was this life in Ireland. Could you tell us when these memories first started to come to you?
They didn't first start. They were always there. I didn't talk about them very much until I was about 3 going on 4, and I suddenly realised nobody else was going to talk about past lives, and they were talking about other things like what happens when you die, which was perhaps I shouldn't have done at that age, but the Sunday school I went to was starting to talk about what happens, and I was just a bit puzzled. It didn't occur to me that people don't remember. For a long time, I thought people were kind of in denial that surely everybody must remember their other lives. But it took me quite a long time to realise that actually an awful lot of people forget, and it's possibly quite normal to forget. I had quite a number of memories, not just of the one in Ireland, but of a number of other lives. Sometimes it was difficult to kind of tease them apart. But probably the memory from Ireland was dominant. So I remember, I mean, a lot of it was just daytime memories. Was it the way it works, it's like normal memory. So if you remember back to being a child, you remember how things felt, how things looked. And it was like that. I would remember back to being an adult and things that happened, funny things, sad things. But sometimes there were dreams as well. I'd sometimes wake up remembering the death, and I think that was something I suppressed, so it only came up in dreams. The location I was always fairly certain about, the name Mary. I always said the name Mary. And when I had a doll, I named her after it was actually after one of the children. I used the same name, Elizabeth, after one of the children. But I hadn't realised at that time. It was just what I did then. But there'd be little things I'd remember, like where the cottage was, what it looked like. I used to draw maps of the village. As soon as I got an atlas, I knew. I suppose it's a sort of dowsing. I looked at it and felt around and looked at it, and I just kept being drawn back to this little dot that had the word Malahide next to it, just north of Dublin. And I knew that's where I had to look. But I couldn't do anything about it as a child. So I had to wait until I grew up. And it was when I had my own children this time round that I started to really miss the children from that life. I used hypnosis to try. I didn't think I remembered enough. It's rather silly of me, but I wasn't confident enough. I didn't think I remembered quite enough to be able to start a search. But what happened mostly, the hypnosis did bring up a few more details. But what it did mostly was it made me realise how much I had suppressed the memory over the years and tried to just get on and do things and live this life. But after the hypnosis session, I couldn't repress it. It was just, I knew I had to do something about it. It wasn't going to go away. It was part of me. So I managed to arrange a very short weekend. Because the children, things were tight, but I did manage to arrange a weekend on my own in Malahide. And it was really strange. It was like going home. And I'd look around and I think, well, they've changed that. And, oh, no, this is the same. And I'd be walking along a bit and think, oh, no, they've knocked something down here. And when I went down the lane that I remembered living in, it was very confusing because they built loads of houses. It was like when you go back to, when you move away from somewhere and you go back, and you especially here and now, there are loads of houses they keep building. Well, it's the same there. And I had difficulty finding where the cottage was to start off with. I saw a few old buildings, and when I got back, I wrote to somebody, because it really was such a brief stay. I wrote to somebody, I think I wrote down the name of a barn or something. And it just happened that it was somebody who remembered the family and were able to sort of point me in the right direction. So then it was just detective work, which is fun anyway, isn't it? and I managed to track the family down. And then I had the problem of, what do you say to them? What do you say to these people? You've been searching, so busy trying to find them that I didn't really know quite what to say. I'd rehearse what I was supposed to say. And in the end, when I got in touch with the oldest son, I didn't even tell him. I was so bothered about upsetting him. I didn't even tell him why I was searching for him. And I was fortunate at that stage. I'd managed to find, I suppose I was searching around for a bit of help. And I ended up with a BBC researcher who stood between me and the oldest son that I remember from Ireland before we met. Interviewed him, interviewed me, and managed to get 9 pages of detail that we remembered that matched. And it went from there. Then it was less just visiting him for a while until he asked me one day how I managed to remember the family, how I explained it. And I said that I believed that I was his mother. And he just, oh, yeah, all right then. And then in future conversations, he'd say, do you remember when you used to do such and such? You used to go shopping when you used to go on the bus, when you used, instead of saying, do you remember when my mother used to? And I thought, the sort of penny dropped. I suddenly realised, that's fine. He's accepted it, which is absolutely brilliant. So that's kind of what happened with the first case. But there were other memories that I also researched. And every time I managed to find, resolve one bit of past, I was fine for a while and then another bit would come up. So over the years, I've managed to research the past 3 lives, plus other bits and pieces. But I've managed to, the last 3, sufficiently to find family members and really get past it. But it's taken most of my life doing it.
So the next clip is from episode 69, which is an interview with Sharon Rawlett. Every now and then, we all have experiences that seem too meaningful to be chance, but that we can't explain in any normal way. Sharon brings together an immense body of research drawn from science, statistics, near-death experiences, deathbed visions, and many other extraordinary human experiences that clearly point to a meaningful reality beyond the bounds of current science. In this clip, she explains an amazing synchronicity that happened to her.
So let me maybe tell you what that defining experience was. It's actually the one that I start my book out with. It happened to me one weekend when I was going to spend a weekend with some friends from college. We were all getting together at the state park in Pennsylvania. In the time leading up to this weekend that we were going to spend together, I was thinking a lot about another friend of mine who was that I didn't meet in college that I actually knew from the time that I lived in France. I spent several years living in France and studying there. Leading up to this weekend, I was just really thinking about this friend of mine a lot, and thinking about France in general and wondering if maybe one day I was going to move back there or be connected to it again in some way. So I was kind of really kind of obsessed with these thoughts while I'm driving up to this weekend to spend with my friends. Well, while I'm there with my friends, we're all in this, you know, the state park. We don't really know the area. It's just a convenient place for us to meet and get together. So one afternoon, I go out with one of my college friends to try to find a grocery store so we can get some food for dinner. We drive around a little bit and we don't see any grocery stores. It's a pretty rural area. So eventually my friend pulls over and she pulls out her smartphone and she asks her smartphone to find nearby grocery stores. She gives it a voice command. Where are the nearest grocery stores? And then because she's behind the wheel and she's going to start driving there, she hands me her phone. So when she gives the phone to me, there's a list of maybe 4 or 5 grocery stores, you know, there in Pennsylvania that are within a few miles of us. And for me to figure out which grocery store we should go to, I want to see a map of them, not just the list. So I tap the map button on the phone, and it takes a couple of seconds to load, but eventually this map comes up. But strangely, it's showing like 4 or 5 markers for grocery stores. But strangely, these grocery stores are not American grocery stores, the ones that I had just seen on the list. These grocery stores are all French grocery stores. They're all stores in the chain Eau Leclerc, E. Leclerc. Each one of them is labeled Eau Leclerc, and then after it, it has the name of a French town. And I'm just flabbergasted, really, looking at this, because I've spent, you know, the last 48 hours obsessing about the country of France. And I just look at my friend and I'm like, your phone thinks we're in France. I don't know what to do with this. So I handed the phone back to her and she pressed a button and it started working totally normally. It went back to saying that we were in Pennsylvania and we found a grocery store. I'm still thinking about the fact that this phone thought that we were in France. I asked my friend, you know, have you ever looked up anything in France? Why would it suddenly go to France? And she said, no, I have never looked up anything to do with anything in France. I don't know why that happened. And it was really strange that it just happened when it was in my hand and stopped doing that when she took over again. Well, I was puzzling about it. And when I looked at the map on the phone, I recognized the name of one of the towns. The other ones I could tell were French towns that, you know, had French names, but I didn't recognize them except for this one town, the town of Carré. And so when I got home from this trip, I decided to Google this town to see where in France it was. And what I discovered is that Carré is in the region of Brittany, which strangely enough is one of the regions where I lived, and also the region where the friend that I had been thinking about, the French friend I'd been thinking about, the region where he lived. And when I saw that, I mean, I honestly started shaking a little bit because I was like, what on earth is going on? But I also had this very strong intuitive knowing that if the coincidence was already this strong and this phone had shown me a town in Brittany where my friend lived, that meant that the coincidence probably went even farther and that map was probably showing me where my friend was on that particular day. Now, I didn't know if he had any connection to the town of Carré. That's not where he lived. It was in pretty far away in Brittany from where he actually lived. It was just in the same region. But I had this intuitive feeling that he had to have been near there on that day, or the phone wouldn't have chosen that place to show me. So I went back to my computer and I Googled my friend's name along with the date that this coincidence had happened to me. And what I got was a page from his blog where he had listed some different events that he was going to be attending over the course of that year. I think it was a list of 5 different events over the course of the year that he would be at. And one of them took place on the day of this GPS coincidence. And on that day, he was apparently in this little village called Kerglof, which I had never heard of either. So once again, I Googled Kerglof to find out where in the world this was. And it turned out that Kerglof was 4 kilometers from the center of Carré. So if you were in the town of Kerglof and you were looking for a nearby grocery store, it is very likely that your phone would direct you to the Eau Leclerc in the town of Carré, which is exactly what I had seen on my phone. So to me, I had this strong sense that the phone on that day had not shown me where I was physically, but where I was mentally. It was picking up on where my thoughts were directed at that time, directed toward that person and France itself.
Okay, and on to the final section, and this is from episode 18, where I talked to Carol Bowman. Carol's investigation into children's past life memories was sparked when her young son, Chase, described his own past life death on a Civil War battlefield, an account so accurate it was authenticated by an expert historian.
By 1988, both of my kids revealed to me that they had phobias. And in my son's case, the case that I talk about most, he was 5 years old at the time. And we went to a fireworks display, and he became absolutely hysterical when the loud booming sounds began. And I couldn't comfort him. But you kind of wonder, kids have these irrational behaviors sometimes. So I kind of wrote it off at the time. But a few weeks later, we were in a situation where there was another loud booming sound. And again, he became hysterical and cried, and I had to take him out of this building where we heard the big booming sounds. And I was puzzled. I couldn't figure out anything in his short life that would cause such a reaction. And he was due to start school soon, and I was concerned that maybe he would be exposed to these sounds and haven't become hysterical, and I wouldn't be there. And as fate would have it, the therapist I did the past life regression with the year before had returned to Asheville, North Carolina, where I was living, because my friends wanted to do a regression, and my medical doctor, who had seen my recovery, he was astounded, and they all wanted to do regression, so I invited Norman Ng, the hypnotherapist, to stay with me and work with my friends, and I just casually mentioned to him that my son had this phobia of loud booming sounds. And since he was a hypnotherapist, I thought perhaps he could give Chase, my son, a post-hypnotic suggestion that the next time he heard these loud sounds, he wouldn't be afraid. And I was totally unprepared for what happened. Chase was, you know, a little guy, 5 years old. He said, sit on your mom's lap, close your eyes, and tell me what you see when you hear the loud sounds that frighten you. Immediately, my five-year-old was talking about being a soldier, an adult, holding a gun, crouching behind a rock. And he said that the gun had a sword at the end. And I was flabbergasted because Chase didn't own a toy gun. He was not interested in war games, as a lot of young kids are. And he proceeded to say he didn't want to be there in battle. He was confused. And then he said, I'm shot in my wrist. And Norman let him through. He said, then what happens? And Chase said, they take me to a hospital, but it's just something like a tent with covering on top and poles. And they put me on a bed, but it's really a hard bench. And they put a bandage over my wrist and tell me I have to go back to battle. I don't want to go. I don't want to shoot anyone. I miss my wife and children. And I still get goosebumps when I tell that story, because at that point I realized this is nothing that Chase had been exposed to, and he was speaking in the first person as if he had been there, and he was describing something totally outside his experience. He used words that I didn't know that he knew. He was very matter of fact about it. He was in this other persona, but he didn't have another voice. You know, it's still his 5 year old boy's voice.
And can I ask, was he speaking with maturity?
He was, and especially, you know, this is what I found with children's memories too. They will talk in the first person as if it's currently happening. You know, he said, I'm a soldier, I'm behind a rock, I don't know what I'm shooting at. And that's what floored me too, that he was in this different persona. And when he said, I miss my wife and children, that was the moment that my world changed. My worldview completely changed in that moment. And I thought, maybe this is a past life. And Norman, the hypnotherapist who had been doing past life therapy for quite a while at that point, figured we were in a past life story, and he guided Chase through it. And what came up was the issue for Chase as this soldier in a past life was that he didn't know what he had signed up for, and he didn't want to be in a war situation. You know, it wasn't a glorified version that someone could see in a movie or on television. He was scared. He didn't want to be there. He missed his family. And he felt bad about shooting other people. So Norman reassured him by saying very in simple language to him, we live many different lives. We play different roles. Sometimes we are a soldier and have to kill others, or sometimes we are killed. There's no blame. It's just we're learning what it is to be human. And I thought, my five-year-old isn't going to get this. But he did. You know, I could see his face relaxing. It had been a little anguished. He had an anguished look. So he talked about the injury on his wrist and how that he had to go back to battle. And he said, I have to go behind a cannon. And he described walking down a dusty road. And he said, there are chickens on the road. And he said, there's a big cannon on a wagon being pulled by a horse. You know, he remembered visually, he got a lot of detail, and it was also emotional. And then he said, they tell me to go behind the cannon. And at that point, he opened his eyes, hopped off my lap, and went to play with his Legos. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, what was that? And the upshot of that 15-minute or so recollection was that his fear of loud booming sounds completely went away. In fact, he asked for his first drum set after that experience, and he's now at age 35, among other things, he is a drummer, and which is kind of ironic. And what really intrigued me too was Chase had had a chronic eczema on that spot on his wrist since he had been a baby, and we had tried antibiotic salves, changing his diet, all kinds of different things, and that eczema bonded to medical treatment. In fact, he used to scratch it so much when he went to bed that I used to bandage his wrist so he wouldn't bloody the sheets every night.
Yeah, it sounds quite bad.
So what astounded me most was a few days after that recollection, his eczema cleared up completely.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode. I will put a list of the episode numbers in the show notes, so if you want to listen to the full interview, you can look that up. And a great way to support this podcast is to sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week, and for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast, and I release episodes every Monday. Well, you can become a Patreon by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And please look out for the Past Lives podcast episodes called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. And there is a Past Lives podcast Facebook group. And if you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.